Welcome back to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld. I'm here with one of my favorite writers and people who are deep in the UFO UAP situation, Whitley Strieber. He wrote the definitive book on alien abductions, if that's what we're still calling it, because in his latest book, Them, you kind of reevaluate the whole situation, Whitley, and it's such a deep book. I think anyone who's had any experience with UFOs or an idea about them should read this book, because you reorientate the whole structure of the situation. Does that make sense, what I'm saying about it? Is that your intention?
Well, yeah, because we're not going down the right path. The purpose of communion, which I must admit at the time I did not fully understand, was to initiate contact, which it did. Largely, more the face on the cover than the contents of the book, actually, because the face awakened people to memories that they had buried, that they thought were just dreams. And then suddenly, millions of people were realizing they had seen the same entities, and they began to wake up to this. And I had no idea that would happen. I wish I could say I initiated contact, but I just backed into it, in fact.
Well, you make such an incredible statement here. You say on page 73, a speculation that will reoccur throughout this book presents itself, that are we dealing not with a rare experience at all, abduction, but rather with a common one that is rarely remembered? That is huge. You think it's true that a lot of people, a majority, Alexis Brooks thinks the majority of people have been abducted. They've just blocked it out, and we are the maybe more conscious ones. Could that be true?
Well, all I can do is speculate. But what if bodies and souls are not so fixed together? In other words, what if bodies are here for souls to share, and the so-called missing time experiences when one soul is taken out and another one gets in for a period of time? And I mean, I don't know how it works, but one thing I do know is that the way we think it works now is probably not enough. It's not big enough. There's something going on in this place that's very, very extraordinary and large. And it has to do with these extremely dense, complex bodies that are richly served by sensory organs that fill us with impressions, but also that the very nature of the situation means that we are not ever above the stream of time. For us in the human form, everything is always new. Our best prophets are at best problematic. But what if reality doesn't end there? What if there is a level of consciousness that is not in time, but outside of time, and sees this as a game, and a game that's essential? Because if you don't play the game, you suffer the horror of being trapped in timelessness. One of the first things my wife said after she died was, "Whitley, this is all a game." But go ahead.
No, you just broke up what Donald Hoffman is now talking about, the illusion of time and space. Do you know his work, Donald Hoffman?
No, but I probably should now. It sounds like it.
He's not looking at it from this perspective, but he is saying that space and time don't exist in the sense that we think they do. And if he knew about this situation, he might not go there, because he's sort of a scientist. But he says a lot of things that you're saying right now, that ultimately consciousness is not bound by time and space. I also prove that to when I teach remote viewing, We're remote viewing the past and the future. So what is it? Who are we? Which is the point of your book. We're not really who we think you are, and we have a totally different relationship with, let's call it the unknown, than we're taught and brainwashed to think. I mean,
well, I don't think we're taught so much as we make assumptions that don't happen to be accurate. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain amount of confusion involved in that. Mm-hmm. The assumption that, well, the basic assumption is that there's nothing here except the present. Right. Now, for us, it's very true. Anne said, the moment is all we have. Now is life. And that's so true. It's very true. We don't have a past or a future. We only have this little segment of reality. Only there's a theory called the block universe theory, which suggests that reality is a kind of motion moving through a predetermined structure, which is known as the block universe. If this is true, then it's A, true that there is no such thing as free will, and B, also true that we would need to be absolutely protected from any sense of future life. Otherwise, the purpose of the soul would be destroyed, which would be to gain energy from the illusion that this experience of life is novel.
But do these beings themselves, they must have souls, at least the higher advanced ones, if they're living outside of time.
Maybe so, we're looking at our souls when we look at them.
Well, it is so much deeper of what the book brings out and complex than our limited scope of knowledge can perceive.
Well, yeah, because the military is certainly shooting at something. Mm-hmm. And I've known a lot about the bodies for a long time. And there was recently published on Reddit a document that is clearly filled with accurate information about the bodies, because it talks about things I've actually seen with my own eyes that I haven't talked about with anybody because they were too strange. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that the little gray people exude waste material through their skin. And they do. It mentions that in the Reddit piece. Now, how could anyone come to that conclusion who hadn't actually had some kind of exposure to them? And the answer is they couldn't. It's not something you could just make up. And as I say, I saw it happening in my front yard and at the cabin.
Well, I didn't see that, but I felt like they take nutrition in through their skin, which is also why they smell the way they do, because it lingers on the skin. So I think they excrete it and take it in like
when they excrete it, it smells like ammonia. I've smelled it.
Yeah.
It's disgusting, actually. They don't have nearly as elaborate bodies as we do. Their bodies are much less dense. And I think that the result of this is that they see more of time. And in other words, they see more of the future and more of the past. And that's why when we look at those eyes, they're so intimidating, because they're not just seeing us as we are right now. They are seeing us as we have been, maybe all the way back to the beginning of our lives, or even farther and into the future. And we know it instinctively. And when you look at them and you make eye contact with them, you know you're not in the presence of someone like you, not at all. And it, as I say, it's extremely intimidating.
Well, go back to the bodies for a second, because in your book, you say this, and many other people say they're taking our cells, they're maybe reproducing us somehow, or they either want to, you know, save our population or transplant that somewhere else or take over.
Who knows what they want to do with it, but they're certainly fooling around with our sexual material.
Right.
Absolutely. They took sperm out of my body.
I think they did for me too. They did that for me.
Well, see, yeah. Then you know. And where did it go? I mean, how many babies could be made from a single male's ejaculation, one ejaculation? The answer is tens of thousands or more. And it just depends on how many eggs they have. And and then this little boy shows up in our woods behind our house, and he's all screwed up. He can't get near anybody. He's like the most autistic person you could possibly imagine, in a kind of state of inner agony. And why was he there? Why was he put there? I think he was put there because they couldn't, he's my child, my son, and they couldn't handle him. It didn't work out. And so they just dropped him in my lap.
So if you look at all of this, and this is what I think you do in your book, how can we begin to fathom this scope of reality that's been denied to us? And because the government has bodies that's come out, they have ships. How can the population begin to fathom the reality of this presence? I don't even want to call it ETs.
Well, you swim in quicksand very, very carefully. that's what I think that there's a significant chance that we're going to get into a lot of ontological trouble with this, lot, because it is just telling us basically that the whole image of reality that we have built up and all of our beliefs are essentially in us. They don't reflect the outside world. They're artifacts of our minds. And what we're actually in is completely different. It's like a fish is suddenly drawn out of water, and it ends up in a pot, in an impossible situation. Of course, fish look surprised when they're caught. They are surprised because they have the world that they're in suddenly has no meaning. Their eyes can't focus. There's things moving around them. They can't breathe. They can't move properly. They have been entirely free in the water, free in it, their bodies perfectly attuned to their environment. And then suddenly they're somewhere else where their bodies don't work at all anymore. They can't see properly. Their sense of smell is destroyed. They're smothering, and they don't know why. That's where we're going. Only the difference is we have a little bit more intellectual content than fish, a lot, and we can do this. How? Well, we're going to figure it out, I think.
You give the clues in the book. It's how the fish do it through evolution. You're saying we're at the cusp of this evolution where maybe we will be able to meet them at that level.
Because the fish did it. After all, we're here because the fish did it.
Right.
We wouldn't be here if the fish hadn't done it. The fish did the impossible. They ended up on dry land and they survived. The future for us is this planetary environment fails. It fails critically and generally over the next few years. We end up without our water environment to support us. And in fact, if you look at the zodiac, there's a very curious parallel there. Pisces is the sign we're in now.
The fish, like we're talking
fish,
about.
The yes. sign of the fish. And where is the fish? The fish is floating around in water. And the fish is being given everything it needs. The water is the earth environment, and we are the fish. Now what has happening in the present is the water carrier is pouring out the water and the fish with it. So what's the fish going to do? What happens when a birth is about to occur? The woman's water breaks, and earth's water is breaking, literally breaking. That's why we're in a situation where we have terrible droughts and terrible floods all mixed together. I have some dear friends live a few miles north of me were completely and unexpectedly flooded out a couple of weeks ago, completely. Mm-hmm. A flash flood just came out of nowhere in an area where they didn't even have flood insurance because the chances of flooding in that area were zero, but it happened.
Well, you write about this so beautifully on page 76. It says, there's no time left to sleep in the womb of the earth. The infant mankind is too large for her to hold. Her waters are broken. We are in the process of leaving the birth canal and coming into a new life, which, if individual births are an example, is going to be quite a shocking experience, your words.
No, exactly. And that's happening. And there's no way to change it. It will happen. It will happen that way.
It is happening. And well, it's happening is what you're saying. It is happening at this moment that we're speaking.
Exactly. I asked the visitors about this a couple of years ago because I realized it was going to happen. And the answer was, I said, what will happen? And the answer was, it will come upon them unaware. And that's the truth, because we're sitting here in a situation where things are going, things are start to fall apart, it's going to happen very quickly, and we're not going to be expecting it. It will come upon them unaware. And that's exactly what happens to the baby in the womb. The baby is living a kind of timeless life, and then all of a sudden, everything falls apart. And of course, babies are crying when they come out, because they're very upset. Their whole world has been just completely devastated. But you see the look in their faces. Their eyes are wide open. They can't see but a few feet in front of them. But they know they are seeing things that are new. And a human baby's not like an animal baby. Human baby's not born with too many instincts. We're born with things like an instinct to swim, which comes from the time when we lived in the sea, when we did once many, many millions of years ago, we were a seaborne creature, like everybody was. But mostly what those eyes reflect is curiosity. And then almost the first thing the baby's going to do after he stopped yelling and screaming and just generally being terribly upset with his situation, he realizes there's people around him, something is there. And the smile reflex takes over, because over the generations, babies who smile early survive longer. That is going to happen to the whole human species. We're yelling and screaming right now. We're terrified. But once the birth takes place, we're going to realize simultaneously with the collapse of the planetary environment, the fact that there are really other beings around us. And believe you me, we're going to put a big smile on our old faces. We're going to be grinning away. Hey, guys, actually, it's okay. We're here. You got a light, food, something for us?
I mean, you're so right. I feel what you're saying. We're at this momentous threshold in human history right now. We are witnessing it. And I just want to get into disclosure a little bit, because are they, the government who knows this, are they unable to comprehend it? Are they afraid, you think, to tell us? Or maybe they just don't know.
They're not in control of the situation.
Yeah.
You have to be trained for years to understand how the visitor's mind control system works, and how it and to be able to detect it when it's inside you. They can't. They have no idea that they are marching to somebody else's drumbeat. They think they're doing this by themselves, but they're not. And we will find out what we need to know in the right time, in good time. And it will end up being a surprise, because the shock of the new is very important to a proper birth into the next level of reality. No shock, no birth.
Well, let me show you something that I found in a Rilke poem that applies, I think, to this situation. Do you see this on your screen there?
Yes.
This is from a Rilke.
Letters to a Young Poet. Yes, I know it very well.
And do you know this quote? The tremendous effort only seems to be so great because we overestimate the victory. It's not the victory that is a great thing that we think we have performed, although we're right to feeling. The great thing is that there was already something that we could put in place of that deception, something true and real. Without that, our victory only be a moral reaction without further meaning. As it is now, it's become an epoch. And I reference that in terms of what the government's not telling us. But what do you make from that, Whitley?
Well, I don't think the government knows much, first of all. I'm not a big believer in the fact that they are holding back epochal secrets. They are holding back a few things. They are holding back the fact that they have craft. They are holding back the fact that they have bodies. They may be holding back the fact that there are people who have traveled to other worlds. That's a possibility. I don't know. But I think if there are people here from other worlds, then obviously they got here somehow, and it's possible that indeed there are human beings who have traveled to other worlds. They're holding all of that kind of thing back, and that seems like the real nitty-gritty. But what they're not holding back because they don't know is the why.
Right.
And the why is everything. That's all that matters.
The why being what? Can you explain
why are they even here? Why is this emerging at this time? Why is it mattering so much as it does? Why are they themselves keeping secrets that they would not normally keep? Because the secrecy is much broader than it would normally be. And that's all because of the visitors wanting this shock to emerge at the right moment. And the shock of their presence will emerge at the same time that every single human being on this planet realizes that we are in deep trouble. And there's half your listeners are probably saying, oh no, global warming, all of that nonsense. And that's where we are right now. We won't be there in a few years, in just a few years. We'll be in a position where every single one of us knows we're on a ship that's sinking.
So you're saying the why is to shock us, to wake us into the new being that we could potentially, that's the why,
if
you're saying.
The shock is not strong enough, the baby is going to be born still. Therefore, that's why, you know, you end up holding on to secrets, and the visitors can get really nasty if you start to accidentally reveal the wrong thing, because that goes for government people, anybody who has such secrets, because the shock has to be just right. And it's not something ugly, it's something necessary. Every baby, when the baby is born, the baby generally comes out not breathing. And in the old days, they'd pop the baby on the bottom to make him gasp and start breathing. Nowadays, it's often done in a more gentle way that works just as well. But nevertheless, I can't imagine the grays being particularly gentle. I think we're going to get our asses whipped, I have to tell you. I just can't imagine them doing it the nice guy way, although it might be possible. I just don't think that's going to happen.
Right. We're going to be slapped on the bottom there. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's how I live with them. They come up, you know, they don't fool around. I mean, you know, I make a mistake and I know it immediately. Only this, I'm never warned. If I make a mistake, they wait until after I've made it to get pissed off.
Wow.
So because they want the shock to work. You see what I'm saying? They want the shock to work. And the shock does work. It works very well. And it informs me, and it enables me to go to the next level as a simple explanation never could.
Wow. So we are in the project. Do you have a timeline that you see this?
I wish I did. All I can say is, I mean, I've asked them for a timeline, and that's why I got this. It will come upon them it will come upon them unsure. I think I said it a minute ago. Anyway, it's going to be unexpected, but it's going to be a surprise, because things apparently are going to fall apart very quickly when they do, and very profoundly. And I don't know when.
So you're saying, I think, well, you hadn't said, but they will prevent the government from telling us too much, because that will stop the shock.
Exactly. But it's a very delicate process, because there has to be something coming out,
right,
for the shock to work, but not too much, not the wrong things. And I think the wrong things are probably involved not so much alien bodies and so forth, but the mechanics of how the soul relates to the physical world. I think that is the secret that they want kept until the last minute.
Well, let's talk about that, because you, Linda Moltenhauer, mentioned soul. What is it about the soul? Do they have a soul? Do they want our soul? That's the part.
No, don't worry about any of that.
No, I'm not worried. I'm just curious.
The idea that they're stealing our souls.
No, I don't think
that,
so.
Here's the problem with this. This whole, first of all, the word soul is a problem. The body is a continuity. We think of first body and second body. That's how the Egyptians thought of it. They thought in the Pyramid of Unas, the first wall as you go in, the hieroglyphs on it, the oldest religious document in the world, explains the relationship between the first and second bodies. What we call now the chakras, the seven chakras, are the places along the spine where the two connect. And the first body, the physical body, is feeding energy in the form of experience into the second body, which is gathering it. And when the body, first body, dies, the second body will either have been filled with experience that enables it to ascend, or it won't. And that's the idea. But it's much probably more like the visitors think of it as continuity, that we're at a dense end of the vibrational scale, but it's not a clean break between the two scales, that it's a continuity. And where did we start
with? I was talking about, that's a good description of aspects of the soul, but I want to know what is it? What are the, and we don't understand soul, I agree, but what is it they want concerning the soul from us, these beings?
Energy. Experience. We have, when you die and your body is finished, what you come away with is an absolute wealth of novel experience, all of it energized by the new. Everything has always been new, and the energy of that is extraordinary. And there are entities out there who will want to take that. And there are entities out there who will want to join with you in your journey. That's why communion is called what it is. It's called communion because it's about this sharing. And they want to share our experience with us. This is why once we go through this what's coming, on the other side of it is a new mankind. But it's a, it is a it no longer has things like a barrier between the living and the dead, but it still has, and this is the extraordinary thing about what's going on here, because it's very, very unusual, I think, it still has that same sense of the new that we possess now. That doesn't end, but what does end is our heedlessness, and our, and we have, we come to accept the truth that all of this, all of the Sturm und Drang of life on earth is, emerges out of three things: climate, population, and innovation. The climate forms the world. In other words, before the Ice Age, we were living in trees and eating berries and naked as we could be, or running around doing hunting and gathering. But we had no tools. 180,000 years ago, 200,000 years ago, we were not organized into groups like we did become later. Then this catastrophe occurred. And out of the, on the far end of the catastrophe here, we are making weapons, we're wearing clothes, we've done all kinds of things to save ourselves. And we are a new species. We are new. And this is going to happen again. We will be a new species, but we're still going to be here. Don't make no mistake of it. It's just that we will know ourselves in a very different way.
So you're saying, I mean, I think Diana Pasulka points to this in her work a little bit about a kind of, she calls it religious, but I think it's a spiritualization of humanity that's needed in order to understand what's really going on. I mean, do you agree with that?
No,
in a
it's
sense?
The breaking down of the barrier between the living and the dead. Mm. If you want to call that a spiritualization of humanity, there's no reason not to. But at the, well, at the same time, it doesn't mean that the old-fashioned religious systems are going to turn out to be true at all. In fact, very much the opposite. It's going to turn out that we're going to discover very quickly that we are our gods, and our gods have the same limitations that we do. And that's going to be quite scary, because we've always looked to gods as being above us and, you know, oh my God, help me, I've got four flats and the water's rising. What am I going to do? God, save me. When you say that now, their God is somewhere distant. But when you say that in the future, you will be talking to yourself.
Mm. I totally agree with that. That's the end of the old time religion. This is the...
It's right. The beginning of the new time religion.
Truth,
facing the truth that we are here. This is where we are. And the other thing is that people, oh, well, I'm going to go to another planet and so forth. You find out very quickly that there's only one home, that we are connected to this planet in very profound ways. And when you're detached from it for too long, things change inside you very, very rapidly. And if you go into the context of another planet that has other, that's grown other species like us, you really are alone, boy. You're alone. I mean, that's a loneliness that's unbearably painful. And you can only stand it for a very short time.
Wait, are you saying because they are not the same conscious connection?
No, because the planet turns out to be a living, you go to another planet and you're going to find out you're like a fragment of one person going to another person. Mm. And you enter into that person and it's completely different from what you may think. You may think, oh, we land on another planet, we'd go around, we'd see their cell phones and their books and their museums, it'd be so cool. I don't even want to go there anymore. It makes it sound it's too far.
No, I get what you're saying. There's something of this human experience, and even on a soul level, that's very connected to the soul of the earth, the animus mundi, as what you're saying.
Right. We are part of the earth.
Yeah.
And when you go somewhere else, you feel that. You know, not Gordon Cooper, founded the Institute of Noetic Science.
Oh, Edgar Mitchell.
Yeah, I always forget his name for some reason.
Yeah,
he was a good friend. And he told me, I sat with Edgar and listened to him describe the experience that led to the Institute of Noetic Sciences and of being so alone, because he said, I was realizing that I was outside of the body of the earth. And, you know, we're like fleas. You take us outside, take us off the back of the old cow that we've been living on, and all of a sudden you feel very alone.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get that. And that's why there's some energy of the earth. And I think it's a calibration of the sun. What I've discovered in some experiences is that if these beings are not from our same solar frequency, it's like trying to get Wi-Fi on an AM radio. It's a different frequency altogether, but the consciousness of these beings are. And so, but we are graduating, I feel. And there's people I feel who are leading the way. Have you met or talked to Chris Bledsoe? He's quite an amazing person. Have you heard of him?
Chris Bledsoe is going to be brought forward.
But, well, he already is in a way.
But you'll hear much more about Chris Bledsoe in the future.
As far as what? Because I think he's fantastic.
The visitors want him brought forward, so he's going to come forward. You'll find a lot of people are thinking and talking about Chris.
Well, have you heard his experience with, I think, Danny Jones? He reveals stuff about his visits from people in NASA that are startling. Like there's a room people go to where they can read your thoughts in this room, and there's hitchhikers that supposedly come back with the astronauts from space. He talks
about hitchhikers that came back from the Skinwalker Ranch.
Well, yes, but from outer space too. There's hitchhikers. He said, according to.
I mean, there is. I mean, you know, someone who doesn't know about a species that doesn't have any science of the other level, no science of the soul, as it were, is very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to go into things like telepathy rooms and stuff like that, because I haven't had that experience.
Right. But as far as Chris Bledsoe, I think he is going to come forward. I agree, because
he is for certain. He will be brought forward.
But to speak to the public, is this what you're saying?
He will become a very important factor. And I'm not going to go into it any further.
Well, yeah, no, as far as what I would say, because he's having a spiritual awakening in relationship to the visitors, and they are transmuting in front of him, and he's seeing miracles, and he's a very humble person. And
that
I
would
think
be one of the reasons he's been chosen. Because without humility, people without humility are useless. There's another person out there who was chosen a while ago, but they couldn't ever get through to him because he's had no humility, and he's been put aside. You're going to forget about him. But Chris is definitely going to be very much part of this.
Well, I hope so, because he's a great example of what human beings can be. So getting back to them. And it feels like you relayed the story in there of the family that saw the beings in the trees. And you talked about the labyrinth there in your analysis of their experience. And it's as if this string had been led from that inner labyrinth to the letter that Anne found to you, to your analysis, to the public now. There's this string that you out of the labyrinth. Do you want to say something about
what
that?
Happened to the family in the Visitors in the Trees story is this. Yeah. It is a demonstration of first the difficulty we have in remembering something that we have no precedent to compare to, and second, a an explanation of how memory can be preserved in a situation like that. What happens is the whole family begins to see basically some of the little grays up in a tree, gradually from the beginning of the experience to the end over a couple of days, the mother is chosen to be taken from level to level to level of strangeness very carefully, so that each level isn't detached from the level before, but rather flows out of it. And in the end, she has the whole experience in her mind. The husband forgets most of it almost immediately, and the children to a greater or lesser degree forget. But she holds this in her mind, and we can therefore use this as a blueprint. In contact, we know how, or we, now that I've shown this, how this mm-hmm. works, other groups of grays can, and other groups of beings from abroad can know how to help us retain memory, because that was an instruction manual and how to enable a human being to retain a memory of this experience. But it also takes to the very end of the letter, where there is a description of a crystalline being so very radically different from a human being, but was once human, that it plays into something Anne said after she passed away. "I'm not Anne anymore, but I will always be Anne for you." And what that means is that the entity that projected this body into the world is not the ego. It's not Whitley or Anne back there. It is something else. The little picture beside it is called Symbols for Speed, and it is working at a different vibration from the body. It's a much different entity, and it has projected probably many bodies into the world over many, many years, and maybe into other worlds as well. And is no reason to think that one of what these things we call souls may have more than one body running at the same time. It's incredibly complex, and it could be that two mortal enemies are actually being run by the same soul who is gathering the energy of their friction.
Yeah, I want to just go back to what you said about unraveling the way of understanding and remembering that this woman who wrote you the letter. And I think that's something so key, because as we, and I hope you explain it a little more, how we can, as we remember the contact experience in its true form, we are actually being changed and initiated and awakened in the process that you're talking about, I feel.
A lot of close encounter witnesses are going to have to go back to their experiences and kind of relive them bit by bit. In the letter, the first strange thing that happens is the night before the main part of the experience, there are car lights in the driveway, and then there's no car there. That's a very simple thing. You can blow it off as, oh, someone just made a mistake, turned around. The next morning, while the lady is washing dishes, she sees something strange. Or no, her daughter sees something strange. A woman with a stick in her hand going into their barn. But when she goes into the barn, there's no one there. Okay, now there's two strange events. One of them perfectly explainable. The other one a little less explainable, because who went into the barn and then there was no one there? Then the next thing is she sees someone hopping in a way that seems to be that they are defying gravity. Now, a lot of experiences will nod their heads because they've seen beings moving like this, because they come from a place where the gravity is much denser and much deeper, much more powerful. and they move on Earth a little bit like we move on the moon for that reason. And then it jumps off of a pump house, and that's an impossible jump, an 8-foot jump. No one can do it, and goes bouncing up a hill. And that's because it could jump like that the same way we can make a longer jump on the moon. And it's telling her something, but it's going gradually from one level of strangeness to the next, to the next, to the next. And it goes on like that through the whole letter until in the end, at one point in the letter, she sees a woman with a wonderful necklace. And that necklace, by the way, it represents all of the lives that the soul has lived. And because it's so beautiful, it means it's a strong soul. Anyway, in the end, she sees this crystalline form wearing the same necklace. And that was a human being to begin with. And it's telling us simultaneously how to communicate with the visitors and how to take it a bit at a time, just a bit at a time, and also saying to us that we are something completely different from what we appear to ourselves to be. And we need to get used to that. And we need to get used to the fact that behind these bodies, there are these big, extraordinary entities, and get used to the idea that, no, I'm not Whitley. Whitley is something I'm using in the world. I'm this other entity. That's me. And when we get to that point, we are empowered to enter the whole universe along with everybody else.
That's our birth. That's beautiful. That is our graduation.
That's our birth. I just described it very accurately.
No, people say a lot of things, ascension, whatever, but were we meant to have this limited experience then for the service?
There's no such thing as someone who could be born without being a baby. Mm-hmm. You have to go through the birth. There has to be fertilization, gestation, the journey down the birth canal, and the entry into the world as a child. And then, and once we do enter into the greater world as a child, we're going to have to grow up. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a process too, because believe me, not everybody we will meet is grown up. There's going to be plenty of other children running around too. And it's going to be just like any playground, full of all kinds of crap flowing and happening and all kinds of wonderful things. And teachers in the distance, gently supervising or not so gently supervising the goings on. But here's a question that we have to ask ourselves. Where does a baby come from? A baby comes from a moment of ecstasy between a man and a woman. Where do we come from then? Where is our origin? Will we, and you know, the baby in the womb never sees the parents, but once out of the womb, the first thing the baby encounters is the parents. And that's why when we see the visitors, when we finally come out of the womb into this riot that it's going to seem to us of collapsing planet and all kinds of things, we're going to see them, and we better do better than just assuming, oh, they're aliens, because we're looking at our parents, believe me.
So that vision at the end of 2001 seemed prophetic for what you're saying, where they...
Oh, Kubrick was wired into a whole lot of things. Kubrick was a true artist. You know what a true artist is? A true artist is empty and lets his art flow through. And that's why when you see a Rembrandt or a Van mm-hmm. Gogh, any of these great painters, are here, a Bruckner symphony or a Beethoven symphony or Mozart, all of this, these are empty people.
Yeah.
These are people who are surrendered to something else and letting it flow through. Or Rainer Maria Rilke, he had a close encounter experience And do we know in Italy, you know, I know the grandson of one of his mistresses, so I have a lot of Rilke stuff in my life. And like all poets, he was flying through them like there was no tomorrow. In any case, not all poets, but a lot of them. In any case, he was, you know, I think the eighth elegy of the Duino elegies.
Yeah.
He says comes the phrase, every angel is terrible. And that is the truth. And that's why when you look on the grays, as I explained earlier, why this is, we look on something that seems terrible. And they're not nice and they're not fun. And in fact, if you read in the Bible, you find that the encounters with angels have been, the few that are mentioned in the Bible are really hard experiences. We tinkerbelled the angels in the 19th century and turned these fearsomely powerful beings into Mr. Nice Guys. And, you know, the fairy folk weren't nice either until Walt Disney tinkerbelled them.
Right.
But you tinkerbell the angels at your peril, believe me.
So they're not nice because they are here to wake us up. I mean, they're
That's
not here.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
They come from a place where the truth is known, and therefore they are here to wake us up.
You know, I just wanted to mention,
awake is going to be fun. Believe me, it'll be worth it.
Well, you said joy somewhere in your dialogue. You said we're here for joy.
Of course.
So many people.
A baby is a bringer of joy.
Yeah.
Baby wants it to be wants us to be happy to have the baby there. That's why the baby smiles and wiggles and tries to get under our skin and be loved. Mm. And, you know, the baby's there to be loved. It's a joyous thing. It's just terribly noisy. That's all.
But you know what you said about the artists and creators? There's a dialogue of Plato, Ion, I-O-N, where Socrates is talking to this poet. And he says, you know what makes your work so great? And he goes, yeah, it's my expression, all that. And he says, no, it's when you're out of the way, when the gods speak through you, is when your poetry becomes great, your rhapsody becomes great. And I think we have to get this personality out of the way, because that's the part that is so disconnected.
Well, I'm going to read you guys a little poem then.
Please.
Let me see.
Yes.
This is a poem. I write poems. This is
this
short
one,
poem.
One so, you wrote, huh?
I wrote this. And this this is very much about, it's very much about the true size of life. Okay? It's called a fly. On my slice of pie, a pregnant fly. She is busy with the sugar glaze and a bit of cherry. Always hungry, I'm sure, carrying all those babies. If I swat her, then they also must die. Her many lensed eyes reflect me, watching carefully. Her wings flutter, busy, nervous. She knows she's despised, but not by me. I have fallen in love with her. Her pulsing belly, and the little bit of hope that somehow in all the great vault of the world, the clouds, the speeding days, the stars, that little bit of hope that is what she carries of the vast of life. Now, that's just one fly, my friend.
Well, we are just one fly, aren't we, Whitley?
Yeah,
is what you're
exactly. And believe me, we're not the fly. We are little maggots inside the fly, the babies. Well, but it's always about the same thing. No matter how humble a conscious being is, it belongs to this glorious vastness. When Anne said, have joy, this is what she meant.
Thank
and of course, then as soon as I wrote the poem, I ended up having trouble with flies. It seemed the poem communicated to the flies that it's okay to eat his stuff and crawl.
You're a manifester, but I just want to read you a message on the live chat because we are live now. This guy, Aaron, says, I have no patience. I want my light body and ETs now. So what do you say to someone like that?
He must be an American is all I can say. I have absolutely nothing to offer him.
Right. Because we have to go through this hard work. We are going through the birth canal. And if we don't go through it, we won't be strong enough, I think you're saying.
Well, as I said before, if it doesn't happen right, we could be born dead.
So we need to be stretched and pulled and maybe traumatized. That's not a good thing.
It's more complicated than that. Yeah. There's always trauma associated with birth. But at the same time, we have a situation where when I say born dead, what I mean is this. If we end up in a situation where we don't save enough of the physical planet to enable us to continue to flow through the time stream, then we're born dead. That we're not able, and it'll take the planet a long time maybe to recreate bodies that fit us. So maybe it never will. That's what I mean by being born dead. Being born alive is where you still have the physical planet, but you also have knowledge of what you really are. And as far as Aaron is concerned, is Alex or Aaron is his name?
Aaron was his name.
What I want to say is this. You already have your light body. You're just pretending that you don't.
Right. You're complaining like humans complain.
But you're denying what you are. This is what you are.
And what we are is also joy. I feel that when you say this is... But one other question I want to ask, and it's like, you are, for me anyway, one of the leading spokespeople for the contact, abduction, whatever you want to call this movement. And if you were asked to appear in front of Congress as the spokesperson, author, and acknowledge, what would you say? Would you say this? I mean, what would you say to the people?
I would talk about the trauma, and I would talk about things like the coming to terms with the struggle, and also things like figuring out how to understand what actually is happening to people. Because to give you an example of what I mean is, everyone comes away from their contact experiences, if they remember them at all, with a set of memories of some kind. Now, what are those memories? It turns out that the brain forms what it believes to be memories that aren't memories in one way, and forms memories of actual perceptual experiences in another way, and we can tell the difference. Therefore, we could, if we using a functional MRI scanner, we can tell exactly what parts of a contact experience were physical events. And we can't necessarily say that what the person, in other words, the person will say, well, I was lying on a cot, and the brain will flow with memories that mirror the experience of lying down somewhere, meaning he was lying down somewhere. But the on a cot part, we can never quantify. But I would say to Congress, if we do this enough with enough people, we will be able, in all probability, to get to the point where we can define the basic physical events that are accompany these memories, and also get an idea of what parts of the memories are confabulated. Mm-hmm. And that will be immensely helpful. And I'm not saying when I say confabulated that people are intentionally lying. They're not. They simply aren't able to. They're trying to. The mind is trying to put together things it doesn't know how to put together.
Well, let's say we get an actual understanding of the contact experience. What will that do for us then?
And for... Say it again. You broke up.
Okay, sorry. What if we do get this accurate understanding of the contact experience? What would that do for us?
That would mean that it would be an accurate understanding of what the body perceived physically. That would enable us to get a better idea of what was being done with our bodies. In other words, what was actually happening to the person? And therefore, from that, we can extrapolate motives and intent on the part of whoever was doing it. And from that, we can build policy, an idea of what their policies towards us are. And from that, we can come to understand how their culture works and what their ideas of the individual are and what their objectives are. It's a very big step.
Well, that, I think if this was acknowledged, we'd be ready for it. And then also maybe hundreds of thousands of more people would start to realize that something has happened to them as well.
Well, I think a lot of people are going to realize it. I mean, when the communion came out, there were millions of people who saw that face and were just shocked to their core. Yeah. It was a shock that went through the whole society.
You know, Gary Nolan said
he caused it, didn't even realize it would happen either.
Well, Gary Nolan said he picked up that book and he dropped it, and I think he ran out of the store. Have you heard that experience?
Yeah, I know. I know Gary. Well, we're good friends. And yeah, exactly. He said it scared the hell out of him.
Well, I think he must be an abductee contactee.
I'm sure he is. I've said that to him. And
what does he say when you say that?
He's doing God's work, boy. Gary is really doing it.
No, he's one of the people, I even before he talked about UFOs, he said the Earth is 9 billion years old. He said DNA is 9 billion years old and the Earth is only 4.5 billion years old. So DNA is older than the Earth is something he said years ago, which I said, well, that means that life is everywhere, I would say.
It means that we were born of our parents is what it means.
Well, Whitley, I really enjoy talking to you. And what else are you working on now? I mean,
I'm as always working on a new book, and it's Dreamland's 25th anniversary year. I'm going to be at Consciousness and Contact in February at the New York Hilton.
Oh yeah,
LA Hilton. You're going to be there too.
I'm going to put that up right now. Whitley is one of the keynote speakers at the LA Conscious Live, February 9th to the 12th is one of the reasons I'm doing it. You're going to be on a panel along with Linda Moulton Howe, Nick Pope, some of the all-stars. Danny Sheehan's going to be there. There you are, Whitley. This is going to be a fantastic expo. I'm going to be there hosting a couple of panels and speaking with J.J. Hertog. And what are you speaking about here at this conference?
I'm going to be speaking about them and where we're going from here. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be coming in from India the day before, so it should be an interest. I hope I'm not jet-lagged.
Well, what are you doing in India? What's your plan?
I'm going to go to Varanasi and to Buna Goa, to the two great spiritual centers. Mm-hmm. And it's something that is, for various reasons, is going to happen.
All right. I was a little freaked out in Varanasi myself, watching them carry the dead bodies through the streets so they could be thrown into the river.
You got to remember not to drink the Ganges for sure.
Well, you know, I was in a boat off the on the Ganges River, and a little drop of water, the guy's rowing, comes up, and I feel like maybe it went in my mouth. So I go to spit in the Ganges. They say, no, 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 you cannot spit in the holy Ganges. I said, but look at everything that's out there. Anyway, I'm glad you're still at it. Whitley, you are such a valuable resource for...
Well, so are you, Alan, and I'm glad you're at it too.
Thank you. Well, Whitley wrote a chapter in my book, a very nice chapter, and we'll do more talks. I look forward to seeing you there at the Conscious Life Expo. That's February 9th to the 12th. Get some sleep, Whitley, before I sleep on the plane.
No, over. I will. I'll sleep on the plane for sure.
Because you're on the, I think you're on the ET panel with a bunch of other, you know.
On the 10th and on the 11th. I forgot. Anyway, I'm there. My day there is Sunday.
And I think you'd probably be at the Contact in the Desert, won't you, in June?
We'll be at Contact in the Desert, yes.
This is the 10th anniversary of Contact in the Desert, which is a fantastic gathering of like-minded people. Are you coming back to New York at all, at any time?
Oh, yeah, I'll be back and forth. I travel a lot. I'm spending more time in the UK, though, because I write in the UK.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I have a friend. Are you looking for a place over there? A friend of mine has a beautiful apartment outside of Oxford, if you're looking for a place.
Maybe so. We'll talk about it.
All right. Let's talk. Thank you all for watching. Alan Steinfeld here with Whitley Strieber. Get his latest book, Them. Come see us at the LA Expo, February 9th to the 12th, 2024. Subscribe to this channel. Go to Unknown Country, which is a fantastic. Anything you want to say about Unknown Country?
Well, it's a great site, and it is huge, filled with, is nothing like it in the world.
And you are one of the originals, along with Bud Hopkins, John Mack, Linda Mohnhau. You are like the Mount Rushmore of the ufology crew.
And the only two people still yelling down from the mountain are me and Linda.
I know. And thank you for keep yelling, because I think we're starting to hear it, or at least some of us are starting to hear it.
Starting to realize, hey, wait a minute, they've got something, they're saying something real.
And it's real, because you're not saying it's this, this, and this, like a lot of people say, oh, they're Pleiadian. It's like, those are like the fundamentalists. Who knows
I'm
where
not
these
in that space.
No, I know. And thank you for not being there. And thank you for continuing.